Section 1. Listening. This section of the test has three parts. You will hear four recordings, which you will listen to twice. While listening, answer the questions in the appropriate part of the test. Follow the instructions. When answering questions in the first and second parts, use the answer sheet labelled with a cross. When answering questions in the third part, use the answer sheet labelled with a pen. Now prepare the answer sheet labelled with a cross. Part 1. In this part, you will hear two different extracts. In the first extract, you will hear an interview with Daisy Buchanan, a writer of non-fiction. In the second extract, you will hear an interview with Elaine King, a financial director and a certified financial planner. For the following statements 1 to 10, choose the correct answer A, B, C or D. There is always only one correct answer. Mark your answers on the answer sheet labelled with a cross. Now you have 2 minutes to read the tasks. Now listen to part 1. Extract 1. An interview with Daisy Buchanan. Daisy Buchanan is an award-winning journalist and the author of the critically acclaimed book How to Be a Grown-Up. She's a regular contributor to TV and radio and a wide range of publications, covering everything from pop culture to mental health. We sat down with her at the London Book Fair to discuss her book and why non-fiction was the obvious choice for her. Daisy, why did you choose to write a non-fiction book?
I should admit that one of the reasons I wanted to do non-fiction was because I could do this with a good draft. I didn't need to write the whole thing before. I'd had a couple of other projects before, so I took a week off to write the draft. What's also great about nonfiction is that nothing you do in the process is wasted. It might take a little while, but you can shape and go back to things you've already written and use them in your next project. It can feel like a slow process with nonfiction, admittedly, so it is important to be interested and committed to your subject. With my first book, How to Be a Grown-Up, I so clearly remember having the idea as I was just turning 30. I love self-help as a genre, but so often we already know exactly what we should do. All we want is someone to give us a hug and say it's going to be okay. So I wanted the book to do just that. In my work as a journalist, I cover a mixture of personal and cultural topics and features, which I enjoy. I wanted to carry this over into a longer form and write a comforting, reassuring book.
What was your aim with How to Be a Grown-Up? What message did you want to get across?
The cure for everything is time. That's what I wanted to get across in this book, because it's about being in your 20s. You need to know that it really does get better, and to be able to laugh things off and keep a good perspective. Since the book came out, I get a lot of people asking me for advice. I feel like an agony aunt. But my advice is that you have to just sit tight. But my mom would always tell me this, but it's boring advice that gets truer and truer.
What advice would you give to writers looking to work on a non-fiction project?
As I'm a journalist, I think in a very structured way. Whenever the book felt challenging, I thought about each chapter as a series of features. If I was going to read a magazine feature, what was it going to be about? What case studies and other information could I pull into this piece? If you're serious about writing nonfiction, thinking about the magazines you love isn't a bad place to start. If you read an article, something no longer than 1,200 words, and think, I'd love to read more of this, if anything sparks that in you, then you might be able to write the book of it.
You had an agent before you started working on your book. What would be your advice for those looking to find an agent for their own work?
Social media is a great place to start. Before I had an agent, it seemed like this closed world. I'd read books about the publishing and agenting process and thought it was a closed shop. I was stunned that agents are generous and so excited about talent and really keen to see it and to celebrate it. For all we complain about it, Twitter is a lovely way of being in contact with agents. It's easy to find out the agent of writers you love. Their job is to find great new voices.
Extract 2. An Interview with Elaine King. After studying international business, Elaine started her career as an advisor for an investment advisory service on Wall Street in New York in the late 90s. She has worked in the financial industry for the last 18 years, mostly as a professional certified financial planner. Currently, she is a partner and director at Wealth Enterprise Family Offices. Elaine, please tell us about your childhood. Where did you grow up?
I was born in Lima, Peru. My father was a regional director for a multi-international company, and my mother was a kindergarten teacher. Because we moved to different cities every 2 years, I grew up in Canada, Mexico, Peru, and the United States.
Was the transition to the U.S. difficult?
When I was a kid, it was difficult to leave friends behind, move to another city where a different language was spoken, and begin in a new school system. I learned, however, to adapt and share my experiences. Some of these experiences manifested later in life. For example, as the president of the International Student Association in my university in Texas, and as a mentor to high school students in New York.
What do you remember being the biggest obstacle you overcame because of your Hispanic background?
Most experiences were positive. In Wallasey High School, I was one of only 3 South American students in the entire school, and being different was actually cool. I was embraced by the other kids. The only obstacle was not being fluent as a native English speaker early in my life. Since we moved from Spanish to English-speaking cultures back and forth, neither of my language skills developed properly. Because of this, I think I developed a better relationship with numbers-driven subjects like math, statistics, and finance.
In what ways does your Hispanic background help or hurt you or change the way you do your job compared to peers?
I attribute the success of receiving professional opportunities to my background and knowledge of Spanish. My background definitely contributes to the value that I offer to families I serve. Living in Mexico after the market crisis in the late 80s, in Peru while terrorism created economic instability during the late 90s, and in Japan after the fall of the Little Tigers gave me a unique perspective that now enables me to provide thorough advice.
What did you learn the hard way in your career, and how did that happen?
In a job at the beginning of my managing career, I felt very comfortable with my culturally diverse team. Another member thought, however, I crossed the line one day when I translated into English literally a phrase that is commonly used in Spanish. The team member from a different part of the world found my phrase offensive and noted it to the human resource department.
On a good day, when things are going well, can you give an example of something that really makes you feel good?
One of the most positive things in my career is watching families come together to plan, share, and invest. I love to observe aha moments during meetings. Sometimes these are silent, but I do perceive them. The best day for me is when I combine my financial planning background with a learning experience that benefits a family or community. It means they understand how to become sustainable. On a side note, I once spoke in the Peruvian Congress to present the program for families.
Now listen again. Extract 1. An interview with Daisy Buchanan. Daisy Buchanan is an award-winning journalist and the author of the critically acclaimed book How to Be a Grown-Up. She's a regular contributor to TV and radio and a wide range of publications, covering everything from pop culture to mental health. We sat down with her at the London Book Fair to discuss her book and why non-fiction was the obvious choice for her. Daisy, why did you choose to write a non-fiction book?
I should admit that one of the reasons I wanted to do nonfiction was because I could do this with a good draft. I didn't need to write the whole thing before. I'd had a couple of other projects before, so I took a week off to write the draft. What's also great about nonfiction is that nothing you do in the process is wasted. It might take a little while, but you can shape and go back to things you've already written and use them in your next project. It can feel like a slow process with nonfiction, admittedly, so it is important to be interested and committed to your subject. With my first book, How to Be a Grown-Up, I so clearly remember having the idea as I was just turning 30. I love self-help as a genre, but so often we already know exactly what we should do. All we want is someone to give us a hug and say it's going to be okay. So I wanted the book to do just that. In my work as a journalist, I cover a mixture of personal and cultural topics and features, which I enjoy. I wanted to carry this over into a longer form and write a comforting, reassuring book.
What was your aim with How to Be a Grown-Up? What message did you want to get across?
The cure for everything is time. That's what I wanted to get across in this book, because it's about being in your 20s. You need to know that it really does get better, and to be able to laugh things off and keep a good perspective. Since the book came out, I get a lot of people asking me for advice. I feel like an agony aunt. But my advice is that you have to just sit tight. But my mom would always tell me this, but it's boring advice that gets truer and truer.
What advice would you give to writers looking to work on a non-fiction project?
As I'm a journalist, I think in a very structured way. Whenever the book felt challenging, I thought about each chapter as a series of features. If I was going to read a magazine feature, what was it going to be about? What case studies and other information could I pull into this piece? If you're serious about writing nonfiction, thinking about the magazines you love isn't a bad place to start. If you read an article, something no longer than 1,200 words, and think, I'd love to read more of this, if anything sparks that in you, then you might be able to write the book of it.
You had an agent before you started working on your book. What would be your advice for those looking to find an agent for their own work?
Social media is a great place to start. Before I had an agent, it seemed like this closed world. I'd read books about the publishing and agenting process and thought it was a closed shop. I was stunned that agents are generous and so excited about talent and really keen to see it and to celebrate it. For all we complain about it, Twitter is a lovely way of being in contact with agents. It's easy to find out the agent of writers you love. Their job is to find great new voices.
Extract 2. An interview with Elaine King. After studying international business, Elaine started her career as an advisor for an investment advisory service on Wall Street in New York in the late 90s. She has worked in the financial industry for the last 18 years, mostly as a professional certified financial planner. Currently, she is a partner and director at Wealth Enterprise Family Offices. Elaine, please tell us about your childhood. Where did you grow up?
I was born in Lima, Peru. My father was a regional director for a multi-international company, and my mother was a kindergarten teacher. Because we moved to different cities every 2 years, I grew up in Canada, Mexico, Peru, and the United States.
Was the transition to the U.S. difficult?
When I was a kid, it was difficult to leave friends behind, move to another city where a different language was spoken, and begin in a new school system. I learned, however, to adapt and share my experiences. Some of these experiences manifested later in life. For example, as the president of the International Student Association in my university in Texas, and as a mentor to high school students in New York.
What do you remember being the biggest obstacle you overcame because of your Hispanic background?
Most experiences were positive. In Wallasey High School, I was one of only three South American students in the entire school, and being different was actually cool. I was embraced by the other kids. The only obstacle was not being fluent as a native English speaker early in my life. Since we moved from Spanish to English-speaking cultures back and forth, neither of my language skills developed properly. Because of this, I think I developed a better relationship with numbers-driven subjects like math, statistics, and finance.
In what ways does your Hispanic background help or hurt you or change the way you do your job compared to peers?
I attribute the success of receiving professional opportunities to my background and knowledge of Spanish. My background definitely contributes to the value that I offer to families I serve. Living in Mexico after the market crisis in the late 80s, in Peru while terrorism created economic instability during the late 90s, and in Japan, after the fall of the Little Tigers, gave me a unique perspective that now enables me to provide thorough advice.
What did you learn the hard way in your career, and how did that happen?
In a job at the beginning of my managing career, I felt very comfortable with my culturally diverse team. Another member thought, however, I crossed the line one day when I translated into English literally a phrase that is commonly used in Spanish. The team member from a different part of the world found my phrase offensive and noted it to the human resource department.
On a good day when things are going well, can you give an example of something that really makes you feel good?
One of the most positive things in my career is watching families come together to plan, share, and invest. I love to observe aha moments during meetings. Sometimes these are silent, but I do perceive them. The best day for me is when I combine my financial planning background with a learning experience that benefits a family or community. It means they understand how to become sustainable. On a side note, I once spoke in the Peruvian Congress to present the program for families.
Now you have 30 more seconds to complete the tasks. Part 2. In this part, you will hear a radio program in which a psychologist explains how you can become a better leader. The expert will mention 5 tips and 5 practical ways how to achieve it. There are 2 blocks of 5 matching questions. You will have to match all 10 questions while you are listening to this recording. Read the questions carefully before you listen. For questions 11 to 15, choose from the first list marked A to H the tip which is being described. For questions 16 to 20, choose from the second list marked A to H the practical way how to do it. Be careful. There are 3 extra possibilities which you do not need to use. There is always only 1 correct answer. Mark your answers on the answer sheet labelled with a cross. Now you have 2 minutes to read the tasks. Now listen to part two.
How would you describe a strong leader? Leadership qualities such as assertiveness, adaptability, and intelligence are often cited as the most important. Transformational leaders should be positive, empowering, and inspiring. Consider some of the following tips for how to become a better leader and think about ways that you can implement these strategies in your daily life. Tip number one. Intellectual stimulation is one of the leadership qualities that define transformational leadership. Followers need to be encouraged to express creativity. Effective leaders should offer new challenges with ample support to achieve these goals. One way to foster creativity is to offer challenges to group members, making sure that the goals are within the grasp of their abilities. The purpose of this type of exercise is to get people to stretch their limits but not become discouraged by barriers to success. Tip number two. Idealized influence is another of the four key components of transformational leadership. Transformational leaders demonstrate the behaviors and characteristics that they encourage in their followers. As a result, group members accept and admire these leaders. Research suggests that leaders are able to promote a specific belief and then transmit that inspiration to their followers. As a result, followers are optimistic and have high standards for performance and achievement. If you want to become a better leader, work on modeling the qualities that you would like to see in your team members. Tip number three. Would you look to someone for guidance and leadership if they did not truly care about the goals of the group? Of course not. Great leaders are not just focused on getting group members to finish tasks. They have a genuine passion for the projects they work on. You can develop this leadership quality by thinking of different ways that you can express your eagerness. Let people know that you care about their progress. When one person shares something with the rest of the group, be sure to tell them how much you appreciate such contributions. Tip number four. Transformational leaders have an upbeat, optimistic attitude that serves as a source of inspiration for followers. If leaders seem discouraged or unmotivated, members of the group are likely to also become uninspired. Even when things look discouraging and your followers start to feel disheartened, try to stay optimistic. This does not mean viewing things through rose-colored glasses. It simply means maintaining a sense of optimism and hope in the face of challenges. Such an approach will encourage the spirit of your team. Tip number five. Transformational leaders also provide inspirational motivation to encourage their followers to get into action. Of course, being inspirational isn't always easy. Fortunately, you don't need motivational speeches to rouse your group members. Some ideas for leadership inspiration include being genuinely passionate about ideas or goals, helping followers feel included in the process, and offering recognition, praise, and rewards for people's accomplishments.
Now listen again.
How would you describe a strong leader? Leadership qualities such as assertiveness, adaptability, and intelligence are often cited as the most important. Transformational leaders should be positive, empowering, and inspiring. Consider some of the following tips for how to become a better leader and think about ways that you can implement these strategies in your daily life. Tip number one. Intellectual stimulation is one of the leadership qualities that define transformational leadership. Followers need to be encouraged to express creativity. Effective leaders should offer new challenges with ample support to achieve these goals. One way to foster creativity is to offer challenges to group members, making sure that the goals are within the grasp of their abilities. The purpose of this type of exercise is to get people to stretch their limits but not become discouraged by barriers to success. Tip number two. Idealized influence is another of the four key components of transformational leadership. Transformational leaders demonstrate the behaviors and characteristics that they encourage in their followers. As a result, group members accept and admire these leaders. Research suggests that leaders are able to promote a specific belief and then transmit that inspiration to their followers. As a result, followers are optimistic and have high standards for performance and achievement. If you want to become a better leader, work on modeling the qualities that you would like to see in your team members. Tip number 3. Would you look to someone for guidance and leadership if they did not truly care about the goals of the group? Of course not. Great leaders are not just focused on getting group members to finish tasks. They have a genuine passion for the projects they work on. You can develop this leadership quality by thinking of different ways that you can express your eagerness. Let people know that you care about their progress. When one person shares something with the rest of the group, be sure to tell them how much you appreciate such contributions. Tip number 4. Transformational leaders have an upbeat, optimistic attitude that serves as a source of inspiration for followers. If leaders seem discouraged or unmotivated, members of the group are likely to also become uninspired. Even when things look discouraging and your followers start to feel disheartened, try to stay optimistic. This does not mean viewing things through rose-colored glasses. It simply means maintaining a sense of optimism and hope in the face of challenges. Such an approach will encourage the spirit of your team. Tip number 5. Transformational leaders also provide inspirational motivation to encourage their followers to get into action. Of course, being inspirational isn't always easy. Fortunately, you don't need motivational speeches to rouse your group members. Some ideas for leadership inspiration include being genuinely passionate about ideas or goals, helping followers feel included in the process, and offering recognition, praise, and rewards for people's accomplishments.
Now you have 30 more seconds to complete the tasks. Now look at part 3. For part 3, you will need the answer sheet labelled with a pen. Please find and prepare it. Part 3. You will hear a radio programme about the changing trends in reading fiction in the UK. Complete the sentences 21 to 30, which summarise the information from the text. Use one word or two words in your answers. The number of words is indicated in brackets. Write your answers on the answer sheet labelled with a pen. Now you have 2 minutes to read the sentences. Now listen to part three.
In a world where there's fierce competition for our time, books remain hugely popular. In a recent survey, nearly half the population in the UK, 43%, said they read at least once a week for pleasure, and last year alone saw 212 million print books fly off the shelves. In our program, we will hear how the trends in literature, particularly fiction, have been changing throughout the last two centuries.
While some things have changed hugely in the book world, others haven't. At the start of the 20th century, the preoccupation was invasion fiction. H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds was a bestseller in the first 10 years of the century. Fast forward to the early 21st century, and we again saw a hunger for dystopian fiction, such as Oryx and Crake by Margaret Atwood. The first decade of the 21st century is one of uncertainty, and the books we read reflect that. Book trends are often led by what is happening in the world. In the past 2 years, we've seen a big increased interest in retellings of Greek myths. Given how tricky things have been during the pandemic, I think the comfort you get from classic mysteries has really resonated with readers, and it's the same with myths. Similarly, during the Second World War, there was a huge interest in the classics. Sometimes all it takes is one book. Think of 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James, to kickstart a trend, in that case erotica. But with others, such as the girl phenomenon, it's more of a snowball effect. What began with The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo gathered momentum with Gone Girl and The Girl on the Train, and it still seems to be going strong. In recent years, one genre has dominated, crime. In 2017, it sold more than all other genres for the first time, and the market is now worth £117 million in the UK. When the e-reader was first launched in the late 1990s, the general response was that it was a temporary trend. Gradually, though, its popularity grew as readers realised that this new gadget meant they might actually have some room in their holiday suitcase for clothes once all those novels were removed. They also liked that every book published before 1990, including every witty Jane Austen, was free and will now never go out of print. While e-books haven't seen the total takeover predicted, sales continue to be consistent. According to a recent survey, 24% of Brits read e-books and more than 15% downloaded one in the last 3 months. One area of the market that is currently seeing an explosion is audiobooks. Sales had been increasing steadily since 2014 and sped up in 2020 during the first lockdown. Book lovers rate them not only for convenience, listening while you iron, for example, but also because having a story read to you adds another dimension. On a practical level, audio frees you from a screen, and a lot of us spent a great deal of time tied to screens during lockdowns. Moreover, the connection between performer and listener can be intense, which meant a lot at a time of such disconnection and loneliness. Now listen again.
In a world where there's fierce competition for our time, books remain hugely popular. In a recent survey, nearly half the population in the UK, 43%, said they read at least once a week for pleasure, and last year alone saw 212 million print books fly off the shelves. In our program, we will hear how the trends in literature, particularly fiction, have been changing throughout the last two centuries.
While some things have changed hugely in the book world, others haven't. At the start of the 20th century, the preoccupation was invasion fiction. H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds was a bestseller in the first 10 years of the century. Fast forward to the early 21st century, and we again saw a hunger for dystopian fiction, such as Oryx and Crake by Margaret Atwood. The first decade of the 21st century is one of uncertainty, and the books we read reflect that. Book trends are often led by what is happening in the world. In the past 2 years, we've seen a big increased interest in retellings of Greek myths. Given how tricky things have been during the pandemic, I think the comfort you get from classic mysteries has really resonated with readers, and it's the same with myths. Similarly, during the Second World War, there was a huge interest in the classics. Sometimes all it takes is one book. think of 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James, to kickstart a trend, in that case erotica. But with others, such as the girl phenomenon, it's more of a snowball effect. What began with The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo gathered momentum with Gone Girl and The Girl on the Train, and it still seems to be going strong. In recent years, one genre has dominated, crime. In 2017, it sold more than all other genres for the first time, and the market is now worth £117 million in the UK. When the e-reader was first launched in the late 1990s, the general response was that it was a temporary trend. Gradually, though, its popularity grew as readers realised that this new gadget meant they might actually have some room in their holiday suitcase for clothes once all those novels were removed. They also liked that every book published before 1990, including every witty Jane Austen, was free and will now never go out of print. While e-books haven't seen the total takeover predicted, sales continue to be consistent. According to a recent survey, 24% of Brits read e-books and more than 15% downloaded one in the last 3 months. One area of the market that is currently seeing an explosion is audiobooks. Sales had been increasing steadily since 2014 and sped up in 2020 during the first lockdown. Book lovers rate them not only for convenience, listening while you iron, for example, but also because having a story read to you adds another dimension. On a practical level, audio frees you from a screen, and a lot of us spent a great deal of time tied to screens during lockdowns. Moreover, the connection between performer and listener can be intense, which meant a lot at a time of such disconnection and loneliness. Now you have 30 more seconds to complete the tasks. The listening section is now over. Please stop working on this section. Now go on to the next sections of the test.